Welcome to the Gottesdienst crowd, where we foster confessional integrity, liturgical preservation, and preaching that doesn't stink. We believe that the historic liturgy of the divine service is more than mere cobwebs of antiquity, but it is a true treasure of the church to be dusted off and brought down from her attic to be enjoyed. So let's get dusting.
Welcome back to the Gottesdienst crowd. This is Jason Broughton. Today we have back with us Dave Peterson. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you.
We are taking a look at the gospel reading for the Great Vigil of Easter. It's from Matthew chapter 28, verses 1 to 7. I'll read that in the ESV. Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen, as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead. And behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. See, I have told you." So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me." Okay, so set the scene here. In terms of what they've just come out of and perhaps what they're leading into.
Well, it's sort of obscure, but on Friday, Jesus died on the cross. Set the scene. I mean, that's the scene.
Okay.
By the way, you read through verse 10 and the pericope, I think it's supposed to end at 7, but I'm going to expand it to 10, so I'm glad you read it.
Okay.
But there was one translation thing there, two actually, but one I wasn't expecting because of verse 9, that the ESV translates that as greetings? That's awful.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is kaireta. It should be rejoice.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's pretty significant. So that's a bad translation. The other place.
Greetings. Greetings, earthlings.
Really? Okay, so there's that. The other thing, and the New King James also does this, in the angel, they translate this perfect participle in the past tense. You seek Jesus who was crucified. And I know I harp on this all the time, but the perfect tense, almost without exception in the New Testament, should be translated as a present in English, right? This is the crucified one. Right? This is the same thing, like it is written. We don't translate that it was written.
Mm-hmm.
The perfect tense, right, is it has an ongoing. So this should be, he's the crucified one, the one who is crucified. Not that he's currently being crucified, but that this is his obviously defining characteristic and the like. So there's the translation things. Context, I was just teasing you, sorry, I couldn't resist. I was actually hoping he'll ask me for the context. I have prepared for that joke. If you go back to chapter 27, verse 56, right after the centurion stabs Jesus, and then the rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. Wait a minute. Is this what I want? Oh, well, that's the whole thing. Oh, yeah, it is, but it's down later. So there you get the guards being set. Only Matthew has that account. They ask for a guard. And then in verse 61, rather, is where I wanted to get. We have Mary Magdalene was there and the other Mary sitting. That's not it. I got the wrong verse. Oh, it's 50. It's where is it? 56 is where it is. Found it. Many women followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, were there looking on from afar. Among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. Mm-hmm. So here, just, I mean, contextually, these are the two Marys. Mary Magdalene, we know who she is. But then we have Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. So who's that? Well, that's the other Mary. So the same women that are watching from afar are those who come to look at the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
mother of James and Joseph could, of course, be Mary, the mother of our Lord. And I think that's the most kind of reasonable thing to expect. But
yeah, but they would have said that.
They would have called him Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. I mean, Matthew doesn't have the behold your mother thing, right? That's John. Yeah.
Correct.
So, I mean, we do know Mary is at the cross, but okay. So you don't think that the two, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, you don't think it's Mary, the mother of Jesus?
I don't. I think they would have, I think Matthew would have said, and Mary, the mother of Jesus.
I mean, the only reason he maybe wouldn't have is because you just had this exchange about behold your mother, behold your son. Mm-hmm. But then it seems like he should have said Mary, the new mother of John. But
right.
Yeah, I don't know. That's the context. I don't know who it is. I think traditionally it is usually been held to be Mary, the mother of Jesus. But mm-hmm.
Well, who those am I to speak women. Against tradition?
Yeah, I mean, who knows?
I mean, some other women. Kind of setting things. So Matthew begins and ends with
earthquakes.
With earthquakes and angels. So the angels announce what's happening, and then they give directions on what to do. So it's kind of like they're preaching.
Oh, yeah. By begin, you mean, are you talking about the birth stuff, or do you mean the birth? Okay. Well, I mean, because they also do show up, of course, ministering to Jesus mm-hmm. in Gethsemane. So yeah. the passion kind of begins with angels too.
Yeah. Well, and so the passion, or so the guards in the resurrection account, and the guards or the soldiers in the passion narrative, right? So they both witness an earthquake. They're both mm-hmm. seized by fear. Only the guards at the tomb don't confess and believe, and they become as dead men.
Right.
That's a rich little bit.
It is. And I was surprised that Gibbs doesn't go into this, but those guards are not Roman guards. They're Jewish guards, mm-hmm. and they are the temple guards.
Yeah.
So, right. They don't, there's no other guard, right? They're an occupied country. They're not allowed to have soldiers. And so, right. You have this sort of cooperation in the trial of Jesus, and then between Rome and the Jews. And then you have this kind of cooperation in the cover up, mm-hmm. or at least they try to get, because they go to Pilate and ask for a guard, mm-hmm. which of course is also rich because it's like they take more stock in Jesus' prediction of the resurrection than the disciples did.
Right.
But I don't know, but Pilate's like, I'm done with this, right? You have a guard, send the temple guard. So mm-hmm. the temple guard is struck dead, even as the temple curtain, right? The divisions their job was to enforce the mm-hmm. temple divisions, which are being destroyed.
Yeah.
And they have nothing left to say. Whereas the Roman guards are actually capable of being converted, right?
Mm-hmm. This doesn't pop up on our text, but silver comes back in verses 11 and following. So the chief priests and the elders, they offer silver to the soldiers to deceive the people, to say that the disciples came and stole them away.
Huh, and that's good.
And appears before that, obviously, with Judas, who is to, by deception, betray. So you have this like linking of silver with deception.
Does it use the word silver? Because the New King James just says money.
Yeah, it's silver. Agrurion.
Agruria, that means silver? Oh, that my lexicon says silver coins or money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I mean, that's why I'm pretty sure isn't the periodic table periodic tables AG for silver because of agrurion?
You know, I usually think about the periodic table a lot, but I haven't been recently.
Sorry.
I have no idea. Homeschool. I know Fe is iron. That's it.
And O is oxygen. And H is hydrogen.
Yeah, I guess I know three of them. Okay. I don't know. Is that the normal word? I don't know the word for silver in Greek. It seems I would have, when I see that word, I think it means money.
Okay.
Agurion. But I like the connection. That's good. I'll take it.
Okay.
Certainly, whether it's, I mean, it's legit. it's a legit point. They bribe Judas. They bribe these guards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good connection. You know, of course, the other thing, obviously, is that they should have. I think it's hilarious that they're not surprised. They're like, what? Were you guys drunk? I mean, if you showed up at my house and said, hey, I was going through the cemetery and this guy came out of the grave, my first response wouldn't be, here's some money, don't tell anybody. I mean, this is obviously a conspiracy. And they don't doubt that Jesus rose from the dead, but they still don't believe him, of course, right along with the prophecy of Abraham to the rich man.
Yeah.
Right. They believe he's risen. They don't care.
Yeah. So in chapter 27, when Judas throws down the pieces of silver, it's Agurion.
Oh, it is. Mm-hmm. Okay. You think they took those same pieces of silver?
Wouldn't that be amazing? Nice. Yeah, that would be rich.
Oh, supposedly they bought a potter's field with it.
But. Yeah. Well, maybe it was the tomb of Joseph Arimathea they bought.
There you go.
Okay.
All right.
So part of that is the assumption of these people is that everyone has a price. And so the irony is that Jesus is the price.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah, the Father has a price.
Yeah, everyone has a price.
Yeah, everyone has a price, even the Father. Yeah. Oh, that's good. I'm writing that down. That's really good. I might use that on Good Friday.
The women, they depart the tomb in the same manner as the Magi when they see the star with great joy and fear.
Okay. Yeah, there's... the other thing, what was that now? Oh, I like too that they, here's a really fun thing, and I picked this up from Gibbs. Their purpose in coming is to see the tomb. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't expect the resurrection.
Right.
At all, you know? No one expects the Spanish resurrection. Okay, and then you have, they come to see the tomb, and then the angel says, this is great, right? Come and see the place. Mm-hmm. Right, that really where the Lord lay, which is to say, come see his bed. And you thought you were coming to see a grave, but you've come to see a bed, and which I think is really, really beautiful. And then, of course, we already touched a little bit on this that he's the one who's crucified. But another thing that's so the angel, but Gibbs brought up another thing that sort of related to this Magi connection, right? These angels at the beginning and then this angel here. This is the first time, at least in Matthew's gospel, maybe ever in the Bible, when an angel, other than the book of Revelation, actually does something more than speak. So he comes down from heaven. He causes the earthquake and he rolls the stone back and then sits on it. And I've for years said that when he sits on the stone, he's making fun of it, right? He's showing its weakness. It's just a bit of ceremony that's totally unnecessary, right? It's a sign of derision. And I was happy to find in Gibbs, in a footnote, barely noticed that some commentator he read suggests a note of triumph in the sitting on the stone. So I think that guy's right, because I think I'm right. And
that means the grave is under his feet.
Yeah. He's sitting on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's right. Sit on it, right? That was an insult when I was a child. Sit on it. So, it was a kinder day in those days. Yeah. But anyway, the angel actually does something. He doesn't just talk. He does this. There's also with the wise men. Right, that the city of Jerusalem shakes, that seisma, at the news that the king of the Jews has been born.
Yeah.
And none of them thinks that Herod's had a son. Mm-hmm. They all, you know, they know it's the Messiah. And so you have this shaking. You also have the earthquake modified with the word great. So there was an earthquake at the crucifixion, and that earthquake was a sign of God's wrath.
Mm-hmm.
But this earthquake is opening up the tomb, right? To show
it opened up the other tombs too.
Well, that's right. That's right. It did. I was going to read. I'm going to do this real quick. The So the Book of Concord doesn't say much about the resurrection. There's no citation or reference in the Book of Concord to these passages, Matthew 28, 1 through 10, nor Mark 16, 1 to 8, so the Easter Sunday gospel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the resurrection just really isn't, it just isn't a dominant thing. But Scare's Christology volume from the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics has a whole chapter on the resurrection that is really excellent. Mm-hmm. And I want to read just a couple of things that he says in here. You could read the whole chapter, but I won't do that. But one of the things he pointed out that you reminded me of was this, the resurrection of the, on the crucifixion or at the crucifixion that they come into the holy city. He doesn't talk about them, but he makes this remark about the other resurrections before that. So I have some friends. Well, this is where you get the idea of the wandering Jew, right? That Lazarus was raised from the dead, but he's not a Christian. And because he was raised from the dead, he's still alive and he's wandering the earth and he's sort of hopeless and sad, right? So I know, that's a great way to take the resurrection of Lazarus. But anyway, this I've had Christian, you know, pastor friends that have speculated that maybe like Lazarus was actually assumed into heaven. Because if he was raised from the dead, like, where is he? And mm-hmm. certainly God wouldn't bring him out of heaven and then make him die again. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's an interesting idea, and I never had an answer to it, but Scare does. So he writes that those whom Jesus raised from the dead were resuscitated but not glorified as he was in his resurrection. They did not see in their resurrection what Paul calls the spiritual body. Mm-hmm. Now, in fairness, Scare, that's just an assertion, no proof, but that's what he says. You know, that's fine with me. I'm a preacher. I'm in favor of assertions. Mm-hmm. But I want to read you this. So anyway, that's just aside. Here's this really great, I'm going to read you almost a whole paragraph starting on page 97 at the bottom of the page. He writes, "The resurrection is an historical event, but it is not one event among other events. Rather, it is the event through which God gives significance to all other events. The resurrection of the one man, Jesus, has universal significance, a New Testament theme endorsed by Pannenberg, quote, the universal resurrection of the dead and the judgment are imminent, end quote. Though man, the sinner, sees the cross as the solution for his dilemma brought about by the impossibility of making his own satisfaction to God for sins, God sees the cross, first of all, as the ultimate vindication of his cause against Satan. With the cross, God has removed Satan in his role as adversary against the divine plan to redeem man. God is characterized as the living one, who gives life, and Satan as the one who brings death to all mankind through sin." I'm going to skip a little bit and then pick up again. "Just as God was compelled to redeem his children, both by his love for his rational creatures and by his honor in defending them against the claim of Satan, so by that same inner compulsion, he must bring Jesus from the dead." I'll skip a little bit more. "The righteousness of God demands the resurrection of Jesus, since all of God's claims against mankind for retributive death," so I don't know how to say that word, "have been absorbed in the death of Christ." And then finally, I'll skip in again a little bit because I still want to have to read you everything. "Thus, the resurrection is neither simply an event which happened, nor merely the act of an all-powerful God desiring to express his sovereign will, but the final expression of what it means to call God life and the one who makes alive. The idea of the necessity of the resurrection is clear in Peter's first sermon, Acts 2:24, but God raised him up, having loosed the pangs of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it." And there's a lot more, but I think, you know, this is like always sort of the Lutheran preacher dilemma. We like Good Friday more than Easter. But here, this is just this, I love this. God sees, we see the cross as the solution for our dilemma, right? The mm-hmm. cross is the solution because it is impossible for us to make satisfaction for our sins. So mm-hmm. the cross is the solution. But God sees the cross as the ultimate vindication of his cause against Satan. And then this idea that the resurrection, the necessity of the resurrection is because, right, God is the God of the living, mm-hmm. And it's the final expression of all this. The righteousness of God demands. So it's really good. And yeah. There's more in this chapter.
And that's in his Christology book?
Christology book. So there's a lot in that chapter that's very preachable. And I think, especially if you're kind of like struggling in terms of what do I preach at a doctrinal level about the resurrection, or why is the resurrection not just a kind of anticlimactic event, mm-hmm. which I think sometimes in Lutheran preaching, it seems like it is.
Yeah.
It was finished on Good Friday, so it's finished. It's over. Why are we, who cares? It doesn't even matter if he rises from the dead. I mean, God forbid anybody would say that. But, yeah. But you know, I think in some sense, it almost has that idea.
Well, I mean, is that in some way a reaction to a kind of modern discomfort with the crucifixion within Lutheran churches?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, even the discomfort with crucifixes, right? Yeah. I mean, this whole idea that, I mean, I used to always, right, Jesus lives means Jesus died.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's the point of it. But I think you're right. There is a kind of, in some places, a kind of modern discourse. I mean, we have people that won't come to church on Good Friday because it's too sad, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that being said, right, the resurrection is not a minor detail or an anticlimactic event or an optional possibility or simply a ceremony to demonstrate that, you know, God's accepted the sacrifice. It's actually a part of who Jesus is according to his divine nature. Mm-hmm. So the confessions, and Scare did bring this up. I didn't start with Scare. I started with the confessions. But Scare brought it up. The confessions are mainly, when it comes to the resurrection, they're mainly concerned with the human nature of Christ in the resurrection, because the main opponent is the Calvinists who believe that his human body is transferred to the right hand of God in some locale and stuck there, mm-hmm. right? So that's the main concern. And then later, right, the main concern is just that Jesus really did rise from the dead and the Bible's true. But neither one of those sort of, I mean, the first one to some degree, but they don't really deal with the theology of the resurrection or the necessity of the resurrection and how it is that the resurrection is a Christological truth and, you know, necessity, therefore, that we must proclaim and what we mean by it when we say Jesus lives.
Yeah.
So you're not going to find that so much in the Book of Concord, I don't think, at least not under the terminology of resurrection.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything to the angel when he's speaking to the women, says, go and tell the disciples, and then Jesus says, go tell my brothers? Is there anything to that change?
Yeah. Sure it is, because this is a part of the promise and the foreshowing of the reconciliation, right? Mm-hmm. These are the disciples that failed.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So him calling them his brothers and is a foreshadowing of the peace that will be bestowed that evening, you know, in the upper room, and the fact that his death is reconciling and his resurrection is justifying, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, I guess the angel could have said, go tell his brothers. I wonder if that would have been confusing, if they would have thought, do you mean, you know, James? No. Maybe that was it. But then, so maybe with the two terms, it's clear. That could be a possibility too. But I do think there's a change that brother is a term of affection and familial, you know, beyond the word disciple, student. I know, it wasn't also though, that was another thing in the ESV, I think, translated, doesn't it have behold, I told them in verse 7? What did you read? Because it's second person.
Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead, and behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. See, I have told you. And that's just behold again.
Oh, I thought you said, therefore you will see him, they say.
There you will see him.
Okay,
see,
never mind.
I have told you.
Okay, good. Sorry, I misheard. I got confused when you were reading.
Is there anything to the lightning in his clothing, like white as snow,
yeah,
the angel? I mean, you know, Daniel 7, the transfiguration.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I wonder about that too. What do you think?
I mean, it's an interesting, but I don't know what to make of it.
Is it just that he looks like Jesus because he's a holy being, or is it just, So another thing with this whole, these resurrection accounts is this is the most dramatic of them. Mm-hmm. He's shiny and he's loud and he sits on the stone, right? But, you know, it's not quite even as showy as the Gloria in Excelsis, where they all start, you know, singing together to the shepherds. Right. I mean, it is kind of mundane and quiet. No trumpets. I mean, okay, you have an earthquake, but right, it seems kind of understated.
Yeah. So to build on that, it's going to take me a second to get there, but you know, none of the resurrection accounts actually record the actual resurrection.
Right.
Like of Jesus coming out of the tomb.
Waking up. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything to, you know, so throughout the resurrection accounts, you have either the disciples or the women, they have certain expectations and they're confronted with something unexpected. Is there anything that we come to the text with expectations and are met with the unexpected? Or are we just not surprised anymore? Because maybe the whole thing is, you know, up until this point, they may have not expected it, but then they kind of can look back and say, oh, we should have expected that. But is that the same thing here?
I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, what are they're expecting? These women are expecting to find, you know, a dead body in the grave.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's any expectation of them. And then I wonder too, so another strange thing, which you started to talk about, is that really Jesus just tells these women the same thing the angel did. Like, was he busy? Why didn't he just do this from the beginning? Or what, you know, was the angel message not sufficient?
Mm-hmm. So is this angel Jesus, an angel of the Lord?
No.
Okay.
Can't be. It can't be. Could it? How could it be?
Well, I mean, you know, the Old Testament, the angel of the Lord.
Well, I know that, but I mean, in this context, it's a distinct being. And I mean, I guess they're not seen together. This is sort of like the Batman, Bruce Wayne thing.
I know, but you know, he's depicted as like lightning, his clothing white as snow.
That's true.
And then he just says the same thing.
that's a good point. They worship Jesus. They recognize Jesus.
Yeah, because you worship now that God is in the flesh. Right, he's still in the flesh.
He'd be in the flesh when if the angel whose clothes is like lightning, he would be in the flesh. That's after the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. I think that's crazy talk. I think these are I don't know what to think of it.
Thinking out loud.
I'm trying to figure out why I think that's so wrong. I can't quite put my finger on it. It does say an angel of the Lord. I mean, there is that particular verbiage in verse 2. It seems like this is very distinct. He's talking about, let's see, do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus, the crucified one. He's not here. He talking about in third person, he is risen. He says he's not here. So there you go. So if he said he's not here, but he is there, it's me. That seems like good evidence. It's not him. It's a separate, it's created angel.
Yeah, but I mean, what if he's pointing to the tomb? He's not here.
I do not like this idea at all. But I'm just struggling to wrap my mind around it. It's caught me off guard, and I don't know. Maybe there's something to it. Has anybody ever thought this before?
I don't know. It just came to my mind. I'm sure someone has.
Sure.
And it's probably...
I'm sure someone has too. I mean, there's probably somebody that says one of these Marys is Jesus. I mean, it's, you know... I imagine somebody said it, but it certainly doesn't seem... I can't remember ever reading it. It seems a kind of outrageous idea to me, at least at first, first blush. But why is that thing repeated? Why does Jesus decide to reveal himself to them and then tell them really the same information? Oh, there was another thing, by the way, that we almost missed. I'm glad we didn't. Gibbs makes this. I didn't know this either, so this was helpful. The angel gives the reason to not be afraid, which is the first time. So usually it's just don't be afraid. But here it's I know that you seek Jesus, the crucified one. He's not here. Mm-hmm. He is risen. If he was there, then they should definitely be afraid. Mm-hmm. If Jesus is dead, then you have every reason to be afraid. But if Jesus lives, then your fear is misplaced. Mm-hmm. And so that is, I think, also a kind of an exegetical reason to go along with scare and say the resurrection is necessary. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
But so, of course, he doesn't say that. Jesus just says, don't be afraid. Go tell my brethren. I don't know. The Galilee thing is sort of weird, too. Right. The harmonization of the resurrection accounts is very difficult.
Yeah.
Necessary, but difficult. Because, of course, he tells that these women are sent, go tell them to go to Galilee and they'll see me. And then,
and then they see him right away.
They're going to see him right away. James,
in fact, maybe they were already seeing him and they just didn't know it because he's the angel of the Lord.
There you go. Well, Mary Magdalene's going to come back a second time.
Yeah.
And look again, right? And think he's a gardener. She doesn't think he's an angel. That little gardener detail is also delicious. I love that of all the things, I mean, it's such a beautiful, it's such a reasonable mistake to think he's a gardener, mm-hmm. right? She doesn't think maybe he's a maintenance man. Maybe he's a trash collector. Maybe he's a, you know, homeless guy. No, she, of course, a gardener is reasonable. Mm-hmm. An angel would kind of be reasonable too. So, but anyway.
All right. So what do you focus on here?
I think I'm going after that. Well, this is the Easter Vigil. That we didn't talk about that, but the context of this, it is so difficult to preach on the Easter Vigil and then come back in the morning mm-hmm. and preach on Mark 16. I mean, at one of these services, I think I'm going to take large parts of that scare thing I read.
Yeah.
I think that's just really helpful and good. I've read it before. I had it all underlined, mm-hmm. but for some reason this year, it really kind of struck me. You know, maybe this thing about the reason to not be afraid is that Jesus is risen, mm-hmm. and so to sort of tie those two things together, I've spent a lot of time before, you know, talking about his, you know, this angel sitting on the derision for the grave, right? That is expressed here, which goes along with the, you know, oh death, where is thy sting, mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah, I've always not always, but I have often tried to juxtapose Jesus resting and his enemies fretting.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, if there were any time for the adversaries of our Lord to be at rest, this would be the time. But even then, they're not.
Yeah, with the guards. And, yeah. And the guards being dead, that's nice. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do that whole thing about the temple divisions being removed. And they can't keep us out. Mm-hmm. The unbelievers are like they're dead, you know, but Jesus lives.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a ton here. It's just, you know, it is also, you know, you're tired. It's late. You've been there at church a long time.
Do you ever connect a bunch of the other texts read? I mean, how many texts do you read?
We're wimps. We only read the four minimum prophecies. And there's no epistle. I don't, it's funny. I never noticed that before. But mm-hmm. this year, as I was prepping, I thought, wow. Because I was kind of thinking, I don't want to preach on Matthew 28 again. And so I was like, oh, maybe I'll read on the epistle. It's probably 1 Corinthians 15. And then I'm like, I don't know. It isn't, because there isn't one. And so there's no epistle. But I a lot of times don't preach on the Easter Vigil. Somebody else does. So I haven't preached on the Easter Vigil actually that many times. And those guys usually do preach on one of the, seems like they usually do pick one of those prophecies. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the sermon takes as long as the prophecies did. So that is a kind of issue that if you preach on one of those prophecies, which is beautiful, but it does take some time to then really mm-hmm. explain things. So I trying to hit the right note is interesting and not easy, but you know, what is the sort of liturgical context that would color this sermon? Or what is the coloring from the liturgical context for a Easter Vigil sermon, would you say?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why I just always talk about rest.
Rest. Okay. Just because it's Saturday, basically.
It's Saturday. He's resting in the tomb.
Well, he's done resting in the tomb. The vigil,
he's just coming out of rest.
Yeah, he's just coming out of rest. Okay. Well, it's a great thing. You can do it. It's fine. I don't think but it doesn't seem to me like the liturgically, like the words throughout the deal are, they're exuberant joy texts, right? Mm-hmm. They're life texts. They're restoration texts. You know, the three young men in the fiery furnace and what are the other ones?
Yeah. But, well, I mean, the point is that even though we're resting, he's at work.
Okay. I feel obligated to be very praisey, I guess. Exuberant, joyful. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe I need to be, maybe it's dark. Because at that point, right, the pyramids have changed, the trumpets are playing. I mean, the music's loud. You know, mm-hmm. we've had this, come ye faithful, raise the strain. Oh, I love that. That's my favorite. Mm-hmm. So it feels emotionally at this, you know, exuberant, joyful thing, which is hard to capture in a sermon. Mm-hmm. I think a rest, I think, would be easier. And I think, you know, it's dark out. I mean, it's nighttime. We are tired by that point. Mm-hmm. So maybe you're onto something. Do you ever use the Chrysostom sermon?
Yeah.
I've done that. Yeah. That's fun. I mean, that fits pretty nice. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously it's not textual to this text.
Yeah.
I mean, which is okay, I think. I mean,
well, I mean, it kind of is. I mean,
once in a while
in terms of the rejoice.
Okay.
You know, yeah. You could say greetings.
Come ye faithful, raise the greetings. Come ye faithful, say hello. There you go. Greetings. That is just awful. Yeah. I couldn't believe it when you read it. I was like, what? Anyway. Yeah. How much do you have your Easter Sunday sermon in mind? How different are the two?
Usually different.
Yeah, the question was degree of difference.
Yeah. Well, it's longer on Easter morning.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I really try to keep it to under 12 minutes for Easter Vigil because it is a long service.
Me too. Yeah, so it is a long service. Also, the people that are there were there Maundy Thursday, which is a long service, Good Friday, which is a long, long service, right? Mm-hmm. And they're coming back the next morning. I mean, it's not like, you know, this is their one chance to hear the gospel, you know? Mm-hmm. And they've heard so much wonderful stuff. I do feel a little bit like, it's almost like, what can we add, you know? Well, I need to say something here, and it's appropriate and necessary, right, that I say something. But yeah, I don't need to be going on for a long time at this point. Mm-hmm. I think that's legit. And I think it's also compassionate. Mm-hmm. You know, but then on Easter Sunday, I tend to go long compared to my normal.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's a different crowd. On Easter Sunday, I've got those same people back, but also I do have visitors and family and
yeah.
I don't have a lot of the sort of church and or Christmas and Easter kind of members, but you know, but I do have a few and mm-hmm. they might show up. So I do feel like Easter Sunday needs to be catechetical or didactic yeah. more so than this one.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's always didactic at some level, but mm-hmm. this is kind of like that. Really, we talked about this, I think, maybe at Christmas Eve, that like Christmas Day is kind of the insiders, you know, and Christmas Eve is the public.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the opposite, right?
Yeah.
The Easter Vigil is the insiders, as it were. And I yeah. think actually probably more exaggerated than Christmas Day.
Yeah.
Because it's
you have to be ready to sit there. I mean, it's
yeah.
it is difficult. That's why I kind of talk about rest, because it is actually work to listen to all those readings.
Yeah, I to my shame, I don't know if I know that to be the case, because I probably have never actually listened. It is hard. No, it definitely is hard to not, especially when you're, you know, thinking about what's coming next and are the acolytes ready and all that mm-hmm. stuff. It's yeah. it is a professional hazard that I find myself falling into way too often,
mm-hmm.
even on a regular Sunday. And at this service, at least, I will say the readings are so long that sometimes, you know, I get, and I don't read them. So okay. are you doing everything by yourself? Oh my goodness.
Yes.
That's a great blessing in a way, because you have to pay attention. But yeah, I never read them. I've never read them. I've always listened to them. But they are so long that I can even actually get bored with my daydreams and start listening to the text again. So that is a good thing. It can, yeah. it's long enough that you do have a chance to kind of come back into it. It's not like it's over mm-hmm. right away. But yeah, that's right. I'm sure I'm the outlier. Almost everybody yeah. listening probably
does
all this.
I have had
this,
on a couple of occasions, you know, we have a member who's graduating from seminary this year, and on a few occasions he's been back and has helped. But for the most part, I'm doing it myself.
You should try. I would, help would be nice. It's just probably not going to be possible in every place.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do know, I have heard of, you know, congregations that will cooperate for a vigil,
mm-hmm.
you know, so not, you know, just one church will host it, but you know, two or three pastors, I don't know. I'm not in favor of lay readers. Maybe this would be a place to make an exception.
Yeah.
Maybe a well-trained, prepared.
I'd rather do it.
I would too. I think the problem with lay readers is not that it's, you know, sinful of itself.
Yeah.
It's that reading is interpretive.
Mm-hmm.
That for me is the real issue. And I mean, besides the Bible passage, right, that we're to give ourselves to the reading of Scripture, but also the fact that actually there is a, you have to be, it's not just trained to speak, you know, to be like an actor reading the lines, you know, in yeah. a way that's articulate and so forth. It's that actually when you read, the emphasis that you give changes the meaning of the words. And if you don't do it, mm-hmm. so it ought to be by somebody that has authority. It really, yeah. I'm fine with students doing it. I mean, you know, seminary students, because, mm-hmm. you know, they're being trained and they've been examined and they've been admitted in some sense, right?
Yeah.
They're not just, but.
Yeah.
And yeah, it would be nice to get some help though.
Yeah.
I feel bad for you. I don't usually, it's very difficult for me to feel sorry for you, but all of a sudden I do.
Well, every year I just think to myself, something you taught me, I would do this for my kids. So I'll do it yeah. for I'll there do it for anyone else who comes. Any final thoughts to kind of wrap up?
Well, yes, I have a final thought this week. And that is, I think you are actually being greatly blessed and privileged to be able to read those things.
Thank you.
Even though it's hard and tiring. Because it really, because you do get to, when you are the reader, you do experience it often in a deeper way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there, I'm done feeling sorry for you.
Great. All right.
All right, thanks, Jason.
Talk to you later.